All right, I'm going to go over the format of the evening, okay? So here's what we're going to do. Mr. D'Souza and Mr. Barker have discussed the outline of the program, and Dinesh has deferred to Mr. Barker and is allowing him to open. There will be two opening statements, each 10 minutes, and I'll be sitting over here with Jason, and I'll be clocking it. We have a computer, and we're going to really keep them to schedule, and I'll be giving them a two-minute warning. So we'll each have an opening statement, and then they'll also have a five-minute rebuttal. Mr. Barker will also begin with the rebuttal. And then I'll give a one-minute warning during that five-minute rebuttal. And then they will engage in a 10-minute cross-examination. And I believe Dinesh will start with a question for Mr. Barker. And then we will wrap up with question and answer. Capiche? Okay. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, again, a round of applause for our presenters this evening, Dinesh D'Souza and Dan Barker. And gentlemen, whatever you're comfortable with, if you'd rather sit, you can work with the microphone, or you can come to the podium, whatever you'd like. Thank you.
I love that choir. That was really pretty. I take it if you're tone deaf, don't apply to the Lyceum, right? Because how do they all sing so well? Thank you, Dinesh. This is our seventh debate together in as many states. So if we keep going, we're actually going to turn into friends, I think, maybe one of these days. Who knows? Thank you, Molly, and thank all of you for coming. You know I'm an atheist. I have a suspicion I'm the only atheist in the room. My name is Dan, and I might feel a little bit like Daniel in the lion's den, maybe. But if you know your Bible, you know that Daniel came out okay, right, from that experience. I used to be a preacher. I have a book in 2008 called Godless. I only brought a couple of them. I didn't expect to sell too many at this place, but Godless, How an Evangelical Preacher Became One of America's Leading Atheists, with a foreword by Richard Dawkins. And Richard Dawkins, I still can't figure out if this is a compliment or not, but Richard Dawkins writes, "Dan Barker is the most eloquent witness of internal delusion that I know." But I'll take it. Anything he writes, I'll take that. Just 2 months ago, my newest book came out, The Good Atheist, Living a Purpose-Filled Life Without God. It's a direct answer to Rick Warren and his claim that without God, you can't have purpose in your life. I changed my mind. As you know, after 19 years of preaching and songwriting, I still get royalties from the Christian musicals, which is kind of fun, kind of different. And I changed my mind because there's no evidence for a God. There's no good argument for a God. There's no coherent definition of a God. There's no good defense to the problem of evil. There's no agreement among believers about the nature of this God or his moral principles. And there's no need for a God. Millions of good people live productive, moral, happy, loving lives without believing in a God. And the books that the God believer are based on, like the Bible and the Quran, are unreliable, contradictory, unhistorical, unscientific. They are not good guides for moral living. There's a better way to live. Secular humanism. Humanism is much superior to Christianity as a moral framework. Basically, I'm pro-life. I think there's a dignity to life. It doesn't come from the Bible. Comes from our humanity. The Bible is, I'm going to show the Bible is basically anti-life. And those of you who are pro-life, who love this life, you're doing so on your own, not because of the Bible. But morality basically to us humanists, and not all atheists would call themselves humanists. And by the way, I don't speak for all atheists. We welcome the fact that atheists disagree with each other, just like Christians disagree. I'm sure most of you will disagree with Dinesh on some points of theology here and there. It doesn't matter. And I actually am a little uncomfortable speaking at an anti-abortion conference as a man. I think my wife, Annie Laurie, who's a third-generation atheist and a lifelong fervent feminist, is more appropriate to talk about women's issues and women's rights. But I'll do my part. I was trained in the Bible. I'm not a doctor. I'm not an expert on these things. But I do have an opinion. And, you know, this debate almost didn't happen, but Dinesh has powers of persuasion. And he made this thing come together. So thank you for that, Dinesh. Most humanists will say Morality is not a code. Morality is not following rules. Morality is not obeying orders. Morality is thinking for yourself, using reason and kindness to try to pick the path that results in the least amount of harm. Pick the path that results in the minimal amount of harm in the world. That's what we all do. That's how we all live our lives. Basically, your day-to-day lives, you are all atheists in the way you live. All religions have peace and love in them. All religions have these concepts that are human values and we want to share. We do disagree on something like abortion, and I think I'm going to cut to that issue because this is an anti-abortion conference. Maybe we'll get back to general morality later on, but my wife, Annie Laurie, was invited to speak at the Roman Catholic Church in Madison, Wisconsin. It was packed. The priest was saying, wow, the good news is that this is the biggest audience we've ever had in our church. The bad news is you all came to hear an atheist. And she gave a talk praising Roman Catholics for the strong work that the Catholic Church did in the first half of the 20th century, fighting for state-church separation and fighting for the rights of all of us to believe in you know, and to have our views according to the Constitution. After the meeting, an older woman came up to Annie Laurie with an envelope with $500 cash in it. She says, I don't want you to know who I am. I'm a member of this Catholic church, but I really love the work that you and your mother are doing. Annie Laurie's mother runs the Women's Medical Fund, which is the country's longest-lived abortion charity in the whole country. She's probably helped more than 20,000 women, poor women, pay for abortions. And this woman said, if anybody knew I was giving you this, I care about these women. I get the phone call sometimes. I'm not an official part of that organization, but a 19-year-old woman who had three kids, her husband was in jail. She was about to be evicted from her apartment for not paying the rent. She was desperate. She loved her three kids. She desperately loved them and wanted to do the best for them and could not be pregnant. We helped her pay for that abortion. Doing that was a good thing for her. Abortion was a blessing for her life. Abortion for her was a way for her to help provide for the children that she did have. I know this is a hard issue for a lot of us, but this is not an atheism religion issue. There are many Christians, many devout churchgoers, like that woman who gave Annie Laurie that money, who care strongly about life enough to help pay for abortions for those women who need them. Somebody said earlier today, what was the phrase? It might be legal, but what? Unlawful in the eyes of God. I don't know where that comes from. I know the Bible. I don't know where that phrase comes from. Even if I did believe in a God, and I don't for very good reasons, where do you get that idea? Where is there a law of God that says abortion is wrong? I used to preach the Bible. What does the Bible say about abortion? Nothing. The word abortion appears nowhere in any translation of the Bible. Nowhere does the Bible deal with an unwanted pregnancy. Nowhere. It's totally silent. There's more than 600 laws of Moses. Not one of them comments about abortion. If it's such a big issue, why doesn't the Bible say something about it? In fact, there's a verse, and you know this verse in Exodus 21, that compares the expulsion of a fetus not with killing, but with a monetary penalty. Right after the Ten Commandments, and right after the Bible says that it's okay to kill some of your slaves, it says, if men strive and hurt a woman with child so that her fruit depart from her, and yet no mischief follow, he shall surely be punished according as the woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judge is determined. But if any mischief follow, then thou shalt give life for life. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. The Bible orders the death penalty for a murder of a human being, but not for the expulsion of a fetus. Mark, can you bring me that water? I forgot to bring it up here. What's that Bible verse about a glass of water in the name of a... You're doing your... Oh, great. Thanks. There you go. Thanks, Mark. You're a good guy. We should have worn our cheese heads to... According to the Bible, life begins at birth, when a baby draws its first breath. The Bible defines life as breath, including the story of Adam's creation, when God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. Jewish law traditionally considers that personhood begins at birth. Desperate for a biblical basis for their beliefs, some anti-abortionists cite some obscure passages from the Bible. Usually they're metaphors or poetic things like, behold, I was shapen in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. All this does is establish the concept of original sin. It just says nothing about abortion. Moses was silent. Jesus was silent. Paul was silent. Why wouldn't they say something about this big issue? If this is God's law, where is it in God's law? It's not in God's law. Have you ever seen those bracelets and necklaces that some Christians wear, WWJD? What would Jesus do? Well, Jesus didn't say a thing about abortion or about homosexuality. So if you want to do what Jesus did, keep your mouth shut about abortion. He didn't talk about it. Keep your mouth shut about homosexuality. He didn't think it was important enough to talk about in his day. I know that most of you in this audience feel very strongly that abortion is killing a human being. I know that. That's given. Many good Americans, good churchgoers, atheists, agnostics, believers, feel opposite. We don't see it as killing a human being. We don't see it as a murder. We think what we are doing is the good, positive, moral thing for the country. If we did think it was murder, well, then, of course, it would be horrible. But we don't. And we think we have brains, we have families. In fact, I know some anti-abortionists who have had abortions because they realized they could not be pregnant again.
2 minutes, Mr. Barker, 2 minutes.
Some people say thou shalt not kill prohibits abortion, but of course the Bible is contradictory on that. The Bible commands killing for people committing such crimes as cursing your father or mother, being a stubborn son, being a homosexual, picking up sticks on the Sabbath. The Bible is very pro-death when you think about it. The God of the Bible commands, condones, and commits killing and genocides all over the place. It is not a pro-life book. In Psalm 137, happy shall be he that takes and dasheth thy little ones against the stones. Christians and Jews are supposed to be happy to take the little babies of the enemy and dash them against the stones. It doesn't say reluctantly, it says happy. Why did God set a bear upon 42 children? The Bible decimates innocent babies. In Sodom and Gomorrah, for example, the firstborn in Egypt. In Numbers 31, now therefore kill every male among the little ones. Deuteronomy 2, destroy the men, women, and the little ones.
1 minute.
Deuteronomy 28, thou shalt eat the fruit of thine own body, the flesh of thy sons and thy daughters. Samuel 15, slay both man and woman, infant and suckling. 2 Kings 8, dash their children and rip up their women with child. The Bible is a brutal book, and the God of the Bible is a moral monster. All the women therein that were with child, he ripped up. Their children also shall be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses shall be spoiled. Their wives ravaged. I can't read all the lists. It takes too long to read all of these. But clearly, there is no law of God that is against abortion. The real way to make moral decisions is to take these dilemmas that we have and weigh the consequences. How much harm is here, how much harm is there, and pick the path. Let the woman pick the path with her doctor that she thinks results in the least amount of overall harm for the world. Yes, an abortion is stopping a potential life. When I had my vasectomy, I didn't have to walk by protesters to challenge my right to control my reproductive freedom.
Thank you, Mr. Barker. Your time is up for your opening statement. Thank you very much. Dinesh?
I'm thrilled to be here to debate and argue about an issue of this importance. Very pleased to be back here at Cleveland Right to Life. I do want to commend the Right to Life cause for this reason. I've been in the political world for 25 years, and on most issues you have opposite competing interests. Dan's from Madison, Wisconsin. There's a big debate going on now about how state money should be allocated, with the unions on one side and perhaps the taxpayers on the other. And that's the typical model of politics. Somebody stands to gain over here and somebody stands to gain over there. But the pro-life issue is an issue in which there are lots of people who stand to gain on this side. And on the pro-life side, the people who are fighting stand to gain nothing. They're actually fighting for a cause that would benefit them in no direct way at all. It is, in a sense, the most unselfish cause in America. And for that reason, I think it deserves a great deal of moral respect. Now, abortion has been legal in America since 1973, since Roe versus Wade. And when we think about this issue, and as we think about the pro-life cause, I think one question we have to ask is, there was a time in America and in the West when abortion was pretty much unthinkable. It is now not only thinkable, but we have gone through a transition in which, at the first, people would say, I personally don't like it, I wouldn't consider doing it, but I think it should be legal. To some, I think, quite shocking statements from Dan that are actually in many quarters of America not so shocking anymore. Namely, abortion is, as he puts it, in some cases a blessing, a good, positive, moral thing. So it's no longer a regrettable necessity. It is a positive good. And I say, without intending a direct analogy, that something very analogous happened in the 19th century with regard to the slavery debate. In fact, at the time of the American founding, slavery was universally considered to be a regrettable thing. Even Jefferson, who had slaves, condemned the idea of it. He just didn't know what to do with the institution. But the idea of calling it a positive good was inconceivable. It was only later, as slavery became controversial, that in the South, the so-called positive good doctrine of slavery developed in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s. And so it is with abortion. So the question I want to ask is, what has changed in America and in the West that something that was almost universally reviled is now actually seen as not merely a tolerable necessity, but a positive good? I want to argue that one of the things that has changed is that in America, until quite recently, perhaps the late 50s or 60s, there was a shared belief in American society in a universal external moral code, a moral code that is not part of us, it's external to us, and makes claims on us. It's our job to live up to the dictates of this moral code, whether it be the Ten Commandments or other precepts. What has changed in America is that that social and moral consensus, which was accepted even if you weren't a Christian, if you were Jewish or even a non-believer, you generally subscribe to this idea of an external moral code. But today we've seen a great moral shift away from the external code and toward what you can call the morality of the subjective inner self. And so when Dan defended abortion, he didn't say it was a good thing by itself. He certainly didn't say it was a good thing for the fetus, for the developing child. He said it's a good thing for the woman who did it. From her point of view, it made life easier. And I think we can see how that might be the case. So morality is no longer a matter of right and wrong, objectively speaking. It's now a matter of what it is in my interest and feeling to do. That's a big moral shift. A second moral shift, I think, has been clearly the increasing secularization of American life. And from the pro-life point of view, this may seem like an unrelated development or a single-issue movement, but I want to say no. The secularization of America has wiped out, if you will, transcendent horizons, in a sense blunted and diminished the idea of the soul, and therefore in some senses raised the question, when we speak of the right to life, well, where does this right come from? A political idea of right is actually connected to the moral idea of what is right. And when Thomas Jefferson penned his famous words that all men are created equal, and when he was asked by the founders to delineate what is the source of these inalienable rights, he didn't say the subjective inner self. In fact, he couldn't have, because the whole meaning of an inalienable right is a right that you can't give away. Whereas if your right was something that you owned, like your property, you'd be free to give it up. You'd be free to say, I want to be a slave. Buy me. But an inalienable right means you don't have the right to give that up. It's not yours. Why not? Because ultimately, in Jefferson's view, rights come from the Creator. So here's Jefferson And he's not that orthodox. He's a very shaky kind of a Christian. But even he, a man of the Enlightenment, a man of science, when he sat down to identify where the rights come from, he can think of only one source, namely God. We begin to see that as the Christian horizons of America diminish, we begin to see at the edges of life a greater tolerance for not only abortion, but euthanasia, infanticide. One of the atheists I've debated a few times is Peter Singer, the notorious bioethicist at Princeton. And Singer is very consistent. He says that morality, including the dignity of human life, what we call the preciousness, the sacredness of life, he goes, that's not a universal value. The ancient Spartans would take the sick or unwanted child and deposit it on the hillside, and they were perfectly happy to find it dead in the morning. So they were in pre-classical antiquity, you didn't have this reverence for life. That reverence for life came with Christianity through Judaism, but nevertheless, Christianity was the transmission belt that brought it into Western civilization. And Singer's point is that if we're going to move away from Christianity, we've got to stop talking about the dignity of life, the preciousness of life, the sense that there is a right to life. And Singer says we've got to treat life for humans in the same way we treat life for the animals. You don't want wanton and unnecessary cruelty, to be sure. But on the other hand, you want utility. You want balancing. You want that which makes things more convenient. And you'll notice that with Dan, you don't have the same advocacy of infanticide, of euthanasia. In fact, many of the atheists try to preserve some semblance of morality while denying divinity. But nevertheless, you see a thrust very much in the same direction. In other words, secularism produces an increasing tolerance, you might say, for killing, particularly at the edges of life. Now, you might say, well, we might see this happening a little bit in Europe. We see it happening in America. But still, we have a relative preservation of morality in our society and in Europe. And that's true. But that is true because we are not thoroughly secularized societies. In other words, even Europe is drenched in Christian education, Christian history, and you might say Christian ideas. It's all around you. If you really want to see what a secular society looks like, you can't go to Norway or Sweden.
2 minutes, Dinesh.
2 minutes?
2 minutes.
You can't go to Norway or Sweden. You have to look at the 20th century experiments, which were efforts to really remove the transcendent horizon and create the truly God-free society. And we have those experiments. The Nazi regime in Germany, which sought to establish the race-based utopia. The experiments in communism and Marxism, which were efforts to create class-based utopias. And look at the casualties. I don't just mean Hitler, 6 million, Stalin, 20 million, Mao Zedong, 30 million, but a whole procession of Soviet dictators from Lenin through Brezhnev, Andropov, Chernenko. I mean Kim Jong-il, Fidel Castro, Ceausescu, Enver Hoxha. The list goes on. Pol Pot. Pol Pot, who was Western educated, a Marxist and an atheist, in his Khmer Rouge regime after the Vietnam War, in 3 years, wiped out 2 million people. Why? Because he was trying to create, if you will, the God-free society. Remember that this is not some accident. This is in Marxism itself. Marx called religion the opium of the people, a kind of drug that numbs us to social reality and social injustice. So you have to get rid of traditional religion and traditional morality if you want to create this new kind of society. It was the atheist philosopher Nietzsche who spoke many years ago about what he called shadows of the gods. And what Nietzsche meant is all of what we call morality, compassion, decency, kindness. Nietzsche's point is that comes out of a transcendent view of things. What makes us different than the animals is that we hold ourselves to be special, and we hold ourselves to be special because we are created by and in the image of God. Nietzsche's point is...
Your time is up for your 10-minute
No God, no morality. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan and Dinesh. And now, Dan, if you could come to the podium for your five-minute rebuttal.
Hitler, by the way, was a Christian. He believed in God. He believed in the Creator. He credited Jesus as his inspiration. In Mein Kampf, he very clearly said, the work that Jesus started but could not finish, I'm going to finish it in exterminating the Jews. So, yes, there have been some horrible atheists, just like there have been some horrible Christians in history. We all denounce tyranny and brutality, whatever. But Dinesh is playing the game that he's played a lot before. By the way, and so far in all of our debates, isn't it interesting that the atheist is the only one who brings a Bible with him? Isn't that something? I quote from the Bible. The Bible's supposed to be the source of Christianity. I read it. I quote from it. And I hope during rebuttal, Dinesh will rebut some of these horrible moral monster issues that the God that you pretend to love actually acted like. You misrepresented me, Dinesh. I did not say that morality is a subjective inner self. I never said that. I don't know who you're debating. I was very clear to say that morality should be based on consequences. The path that results in the least amount of harm is the path that we should pick. In nature, there's no morality. In nature, there's consequences. And so moral dilemmas always involve a conflict of values. Should I vote for stinky or should I vote for bully? Yeah, those are my two choices. I have to compare these values. Moral decisions are not always a black and white thing. It's not a code. You can't look up a list in your back pocket and say, oh, what should I do here? We all live our lives situationally in the relative world of having to balance values. If you think abortion is killing a human being, then don't have one. Millions of good women, good church-going women, atheists and agnostics and church women, don't think that. They're not forcing you to have an abortion. They have their own consequentialist view of what makes sense. And they don't value the fetus in the same way that you do. If you do, fine. That's your choice. But so you're misrepresenting my position. You're not debating Nietzsche tonight or Peter Singer. You're debating what I have said. Jefferson, by the way, did not say God. He had mentioned the Creator. And if you know Jefferson was a deist, he cut out a whole bunch of crap from the Bible. He used the word dunghill. And then he said, there, with this little that's left, if you want to call me a Christian, you can. But Jefferson's God was the deistic God of nature. It wasn't a personal God. You said that he referred to God. He referred to the Creator and nature's God, which really for deists was an impersonal force of nature. The Bible is pro-slavery. The Bible, the churches in the South were using the Bible to promote slavery. Yes, slavery is a bad idea, but we abolish slavery in spite of the Bible. Look it through the Bible. It's a handbook for how to buy and own and have your slaves. Even Jesus demonstrated his compassion by saying there are some slaves you should not beat as hard as others. Why didn't Jesus say, by the way, folks, slavery is a bad idea? He couldn't, because the people who put words in his mouth didn't know any better. They were still victims of that ancient mentality. Dinesh asks, what has changed in the West? This big mystery. What is it that has changed? I'll tell you what has changed in the West. Women's rights. Women have come into full participation in the democracy. We've never had a true liberal democracy until women had the right to vote in this country. In the 19th century, women didn't have. They didn't own their property. They didn't own their children. They couldn't go to college. They didn't own their paycheck. It was because of atheists like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and agnostics like Susan B. Anthony who fought for women's rights so that women could have some control in their lives. And now in the 20th century, in the 21st century, women have come into a full participation in the world. They have something to say. That is what has changed, and that has changed for the better. Margaret Sanger. I know many of you demonize Margaret Sanger, but most people who demonize Margaret Sanger still practice birth control. I bet most women in this room have practiced birth control. Birth control is a good thing, and the Pope is too religious to care about birth control. He's contributing to the misery of the world. He's too religious to be a good person. So what has changed in the West? It is women's values.
One minute.
I'm hoping that Dinesh will continue to rebut what I said about the Bible. But I have a moment to read a couple more things here.
You have 47 seconds.
Well, then why don't I just quit now? We'll go to cross-examination. Or we'll let him do his rebuttal.
He has his rebuttal. Thank you.
Good. I touched on all his points.
Dinesh, your five-minute rebuttal.
Somewhat like the mosquito in the nudist colony, I'm trying to decide where to begin. Dan, Ben was raised, I think, in a kind of a fundamentalist tradition, and he tends to see Christianity as being a product exclusively of the Bible. He says the Bible is the source of Christianity. In fact, even if there had never been a Bible, there would still be Christianity. The source of Christianity is Christ. It's all there in the name. The Bible is a compilation of books, many of which predate Christianity. In fact, pretty much every quotation from Dan comes from the Old Testament. And while he might have scored some points against the rabbis, he scores no points against Christianity, because for 2,000 years, Christianity has read the Old Testament in the light of the New. There's a famous saying in Christianity that the New Testament is in the Old concealed. The Old Testament is in the New revealed. Virtually none of the Jewish practices of the Old Testament are continued in the New. And the tribal, jealous God of the Old Testament is universalized. And the teachings of the Old Testament are very explicitly and in some radical way challenged by Jesus. So that's important to keep in mind as we think about all this. The Bible has to be read contextually, developmentally. It cannot just be read, you might say, literally. But that is Dan's way. So Dan, in some ways, has become an atheist, but he's still kind of a fundamentalist. He's an atheist fundamentalist. And he has a lot in common with the fundamentalists, namely a certain dogmatism about the Bible, a certain literalism, and a certain lack of nuance. Now, let's turn to the issue for a moment about slavery, because I think it's in a way very critical here. It's interesting that slavery was in every known culture, and the only culture where slavery became controversial is in Western culture, the culture known as Christendom. The only people who opposed slavery and the only movements against slavery were developed, concocted, inspired, and led by Christians. By the way, Dan in other debates has said this is in the time of the Enlightenment. Nonsense. Slavery was abolished in Europe between the 5th century and the 10th century. There were virtually no slaves by the late Middle Ages in Europe. So here is Christian Europe getting rid of slavery on its own. The evangelical Christians, the Quakers, they said if all men are created equal in the eyes of God, no man has the right to rule another man without consent. And so this theological idea of spiritual equality is translated into the political idea that not only drives abolition, but also democracy. What is modern democracy based on? No man or no person has the right to rule another without consent. So it is a historical fact that slavery, which existed everywhere, was only abolished here, and abolition movements had to carry those ideas abroad. It's a historical fact that the Christians are the ones who got rid of this institution. Now, during the Lincoln-Douglas debates, it was Douglas, the defender, the opponent of Lincoln, who said, in effect, the pro-choice position. He said what Dan says. If you don't like slavery, don't have a slave. He said, let each community vote up or down as to whether it wants slavery. He was a real pro-choicer. He even denied he was for slavery. He just said, I think it should be up to each community.
Finish. 1 minute.
It should be up to each community to decide for itself. And what was Lincoln's answer? Lincoln's answer was, this makes absolutely no sense. Yes, if you're deciding whether to have steak or pork or vegetarian for dinner, that's a matter of free choice. But how can you use the doctrine or slogan of free choice to deny choice to another person? How can you use the invocation of rights, states' rights, to deny the right of another human being to work and keep the fruits of his labor? And by analogy, we can use the same argument on abortion. Yes, we have choice, but choice with regard to what? Is there choice to kill somebody else? Dan says that if you don't like abortion, don't have one. But he implies, on the other hand, that other people should be free to kill their own offspring. Now, you might say, well, we don't agree that it is an offspring. But what's particularly incredible to me is we live at a time when we are extending our circles of compassion wider and wider.
Your time is up, Dinesh. Your time is up for your rebuttal. Thank you.
Why not to the unborn?
Yeah.
Thank you.
And now for the cross-examination, if you both like to come back to the podium or take the wireless mics at your seats, it's your choice. And we'll have a 10-minute cross-examination. And Dinesh, I believe, are you going to start or would you like Mr.
I think Dan
Dale
goes first because okay. I spoke last. Okay. Dan, your turn.
So if Christianity is not based on the Bible, if your knowledge of Christ and Jesus doesn't come from the Bible, where does it come from? From the air? Do you make it up? What is the source of your Christian faith, if not the Bible?
Well, first of all, let's remember that we didn't have a Bible in its current form for hundreds of years after Christ. There was an Old Testament. When Jesus spoke about the Scriptures, it was just that. Then there were the Gospels written by and large by the first century. And then there were councils around the third century and the fourth century that got together and decided this will be the Bible. So the point I'm trying to make here is simply this, that there was a church that preceded the Bible. There was an apostolic tradition that preceded the Bible. There was a Christian community that preceded the Bible. What we call the Bible was assembled later so that people who were not there at the time could remember and follow these developments that other people knew personally. So the bottom line of it is, yes, of course the Bible is a reliable source of knowledge. There were four Gospels written to describe Jesus' life. I'm not denying the central importance of the Bible. I'm simply denying, you may say, the fundamentalist assertion that without the Bible we wouldn't have morality. Hey, when I read the Ten Commandments, it's not like I said, oh, killing is wrong? Incredible. I didn't know that. Stealing? Wow, what a revelation. I already knew those things were wrong. The morality is embedded in conscience. It was already in my heart. The Bible confirmed it, but it didn't establish it.
So how do you know what Jesus said or did or wants? How do you know that?
Well, yes, it is recorded in the Bible. So, yes, I say this, the sayings of Jesus are described by the people who were there and the people who came shortly after who wrote those things down.
And where's the Bible anti-slavery and anti-abortion? Where is that in the Bible? The book that your religion is based on, where is that?
Well, it is in the Bible. Now, you have to know how to read the Bible. In other words, the Bible is a statement of narrative, of historical event, of a broad descriptive assertion and a moral principle.
We all know that. Yeah.
So, have you heard of the commandment, thou shalt not murder?
In Hebrew, it's thou shalt not kill.
But thou shalt not kill.
I thought you said the Old Testament.
Understood, not that no killing is ever.
But you just told us the Old Testament is irrelevant.
I didn't say it was irrelevant. I said that the teachings of the Old Testament, which were given to one people, Israel, the chosen people, were universalized and in some ways transformed. And so the great debate, for example, between Paul and some of the other apostles over whether new converts should keep the Jewish law, which was won by Paul, and the new converts didn't keep the Jewish law. So clearly, many of the specific teachings of the Old Testament were left behind.
And as you said earlier, we knew that it was wrong to kill before the Ten Commandments. Cultures long before Judaism, before the Israelites claimed the copyright to that idea, human beings figured, as if we were too stupid to figure it out on our own. That's not a biblical principle. That's basically a humanistic principle you're talking about, that Christianity has borrowed from our human nature. That's not a religious idea. The Ten Commandments, you know, they're not really that moral.
I didn't say they were.
Okay.
Okay, so let's look at what we're talking about. There is a certain intrinsic moral revulsion to certain things. So, for example, if I were to bring a dog and stomp on it, there would be a universal feeling of horror that went through the room. That's conscience.
For most people.
The universal voice of morality. What
for,
Adam Smith
for most people. There's a few. That
for most people. Yeah. If it was a cat, it would be different. But we're not talking about that. So, I'm not talking about, so there is a universal moral instinct, but different cultures weigh that differently. And so, for example, as I say, the ancient Greeks thought that there were other values that trumped, you might say, the revulsion of killing an infant. I mean, it is universally abominable not only to kill a child, but to kill your own child. That has got to be a very difficult thing to do. Even defenders of abortion admit that it is. You have to almost hold your nose and do it. And yet you do it. Why? Because for the same reason that people did slavery. It must have been abominable to take people, tie them up, cut off their fingers, put them up into auctions, label them their body parts. This must have been a very shocking and appalling thing to do. But why did people do it? because there was a powerful self-interest and profit motive on the other side. A slave in 1830 cost $1,500, a lot of money in those days. And so the universal human desire for gain trumped, if you will, this moral feeling. That's
so
the point.
Why didn't Jesus say that then? Why did he incorporate slavery? Why did he say you should beat some slaves harder than... Why didn't he say slavery is a bad idea? This universal, all-loving, all-knowing deity. Why is the Bible totally silent? Why is the Bible so pro-slavery?
Well, the Bible is not pro-slavery. The Bible comes into an existing society in which there are practices, including slavery. And what the Bible does is humanize those practices, make them better. It doesn't transform them overnight, but it introduces anti-slavery principles. By the way, if this seems like a weird way to operate, let's remember this is exactly what the American founders did. This is exactly what Abraham Lincoln did. When Lincoln was anti-slavery, no one would deny that. But Lincoln recognized that the founders had allowed slavery. Slavery was part of the fabric of America. And so Lincoln said, I'm not trying to abolish slavery overnight in the South. No. I'm simply trying to block the extension of slavery. And Lincoln's idea was that by blocking the extension of slavery politically, it would weaken the institution. Now, Jesus was not a political guy. He wasn't a statesman. He didn't run for office. He was actually a small guy in a Jewish community, which was under a Roman community. So Jesus's political influence at that level was almost nil. Jesus was, in that sense, a spiritual figure. All right. I think your 5 minutes are up.
You can ask
my
me.
Turn.
All right.
All right. Do you believe that morality is objective? Or do you believe that morality is purely subjective?
I believe that there is an objective basis on which we can make moral decisions. I don't believe morality is a thing. Morality is no big object. But when we are making moral decisions... By the way, I like your analogy. Because I feel like I'm being attacked by a mosquito tonight. I don't know if I were you... If I would compare myself to a disease-ridden parasite, but if that's how you picture yourself.
Well, Socrates did. He described himself as a mosquito that was a gadfly, is what he called himself. But his point was that the value of the gadfly is that by raising tough questions, it exposes, if you will, the hidden premises within ideals. That's a little bit of what I'm trying to do tonight.
Okay.
So I understand this making you uncomfortable, but that's...
But
that's
the point, a consequentialist ethics says... that harm, which is what we're trying to minimize. We're trying to have a world with less violence and less harm in it, right? That's what morality means. It doesn't mean kissing the feet of some daddy whose ego is so fragile that if you don't worship on him on one day of the week that he's going to scorch the earth and send everybody to hell. That's not what morality is, bowing to a dictator and following rules. That's the Nuremberg defense. But morality is basically looking at harm, and harm is natural. Harm is pain, disease, suffering, whatever. Harm is a natural thing. So to make a moral decision, you weigh the relative merits of the consequences of two or more actions, and you say, now, on balance, how do we end up with the least amount of harm? Sometimes we don't know. And so a moral person is then obligated to become as educated as possible. So there is an objective basis. Morality is not an objective thing. It's just a functioning of a brain that has values. The objective basis is innate, the consequences of harm. A glass of water is not harmful, but a glass of arsenic is. So that would objectively inform our moral decisions. This pollution being dumped into the river as compared to this one. It's a physical, natural thing. So there's an objective basis on which we then make our moral judgments.
Would you agree that an abortion harms a developing life?
Yes, it does. But it's not a human being. It's not a person. It does. I think that when I had my vasectomy, I harmed that egg that should have been fertilized. If my wife wanted another baby, by the way. And by me having a vasectomy, I stopped that egg, that life from coming into existence. I don't call that murder. I don't call that killing a human being. But there was harm to that egg that eventually got sloughed out. By the way, we all know that most pregnancies end in spontaneous miscarriages, which makes God the greatest abortionist of all history then. If we want to be more godlike...
Dan, right? Okay, don't filibuster me. The point I'm trying to make here is this.
I'm just following your example.
When we define harm, isn't it convenient to define harm in such a way that our own convenience is maximized?
No, so in other words, I agree. But I just said I agree. When you step on an acorn, you're harming a potential oak tree. You're causing harm. But moral decisions have to be weighing the relative merits. And the life of that woman and the three children or more that she has are, to her, a greater value that outweighs the harm to this little tiny, littler than your fingernail. Most abortions happen in the first trimester when it's nothing. It's a potential human being. There's harm to that fetus. I admit there's harm to that fetus, but since it is not a person, it's not a fully developed human being at that point, then that harm weighed against the harm of the woman's freedom in her life is outweighed. The woman has the right to make that choice. So I'm not saying it's black and white.
Using an example given by Peter Singer, he points out He points out that a 5-year-old dog or a cat has more sentience, more ability to comprehend the world than a newborn fetus, let's say a 1-month-old baby. And he says for this reason, mothers should, for any reason, be able to kill a newborn for, I believe he said, 27 days. Now, he's defining harm exactly as you are. He's weighing the compass slightly differently than you are. You would stop at birth. But to Peter Singer, the difference between an 8.5-month-old fetus and a 10-day-old infant is only geographic. It has been relocated, if you will, from the womb. And modern technology could have taken it out considerably earlier. My question is this. What changes in the calculus with the 10-day-old infant that makes it, confers on it all these rights that were obviously not there just 10 days earlier?
The law.
So the law here, in other words, is the law an expression of morality or merely of the consensus of society?
Well, it's both. All laws are morally based, and so society has decided and has voted that, just like the ancient Israelites and just like the Jews, that we consider birth, your birthday is from the day you were born. We consider birth.
Let me ask you this last question, Dan. You earlier referred to the Bible. In fact, there's no social consensus on abortion. There was no legislative approval of it. This was decided by the Supreme Court based on the Constitution. So I ask you, where is the right to abortion in the Constitution? Quote it for me.
Women have rights, the consent of the government. Women have the rights to their own lives and their own personhood. The pursuit of happiness that they have in the Constitution applies to them.
The pursuit of happiness is in the Declaration of Independence. It's not in the Constitution.
Okay, but in any event, it's based on... And Jefferson's comments were not in the Constitution either. Jefferson's were in the Declaration.
Right, but constitutional rights need to be in the Constitution. Where is the abortion right in the Constitution? Or is it not there and you think it should be in there?
We the people govern ourselves. There's no consent of the governed in the Bible.
Thank you very much. We'll open it up for a question and answer. Give our panelists, our debaters, a round of applause. Thank you very much. We have just about 13 minutes for a question and answer, and we ask you again to raise your hands, and one of our mic holders will come to you. And please keep your questions short and stick to the question. No pontificating, no pun intended, but we want to keep it very short so we can get as many questions in as possible in the next 13 minutes. Thank you.
Mr. Parker?
Barker with a B.
I'm sorry, yeah. Parker. I believe you said that... that morality has an objective basis by which we make decisions, weigh the balance of what the most harm will end up being. And by that, we make moral decisions, something like that. I'm trying to quote you correctly. So my question is that if that's true, then is that decision that's made based on the relative situation that the individual is in, if that's true, then is that decision based in light of the good of the community, the common good, you might say, or is it made in light of the particular good of the individual? In other words, is there a good of the community, a good of all, by which we can truly say, yes, this is good, or is it just... No, it's my good. It's good for me.
Morality is a social question. It involves our interactions with other people. Morality is not just me deciding what I want to do subjectively, as Dinesh tries to to paint us atheists. A moral decision is always a social decision between people. How does it affect other people? Well, ethics and morality deal with that. So you can't make, yes, it's all relativistic, and we all know that. Even the Bible praised a liar for telling a lie for God's people. If somebody knocks on your door, a woman knocks on your door, and she's bleeding and bruised, and she says, "My husband's trying to kill me." You bring her in, you care for her, you clean her up, you give her a place to stay. Later that night, the husband comes to the door, says, "Do you know where my wife is?" As a moral person, you should lie to that man. A lie is a good thing in that situation. You can't make a rule that it's always wrong to lie. You would risk greater harm to that woman's life by telling that man the truth. Sometimes a lie is the best thing, and the Bible even admits it. Rahab told a lie to protect God's people. So all moral decisions are relativistic and situational and conditional depending on the context. Sometimes this action might be right, and sometimes it might be wrong, depending on it. Sometimes there might be a case where an abortion really is wrong. I'm not going to decide that for the woman, but I'm willing to admit there might be cases where that is true. But I think in most cases when a woman makes that choice, she's making a balanced decision with competing values and realizing this little tiny fetus that could be a child someday, I can't do justice to it or to my children. I'm making a good moral decision. And for her, that abortion was a blessing. My daughter had an abortion. She went on to have another child. She didn't regret it. She didn't feel bad about it. I didn't miss having another grandchild. I already have 8 grandchildren. So if some of you feel that way, some of you, your heartstrings are tugged by this feeling, oh, there's a life that could have been. Others of us don't feel that way. Feel the way you feel. But when you weigh moral actions against each other and you're trying to do the calculus to see what's the least amount of harm, you have to give the woman that freedom to make that choice. And that's consequentialist and it's not subjective.
We want to make sure we have questions for both
Teresa,
the panelists.
Can I go briefly?
Yes, you can. I was just going to say we'll let Dinesh respond to make sure we have questions for both of the panelists, please.
The problem with consequentialism is that when we dig within us, we somehow always seem to come out with decisions that benefit us, in which our interests trump moral feeling and moral considerations. You see this happening in a way with Jefferson. Of all the founders, Jefferson was probably the most racist. And what I mean by that was he made the most derogatory remarks about the intrinsic abilities of blacks. And for many years I puzzled about that. Why was Jefferson that way? Why did he make these comments about blacks? And in a way, I think this is the reason. Jefferson had 200 slaves. At the same time, Jefferson wrote and believed that all men are created equal. How do you reconcile those two statements? If you really believe all men are created equal and you have 200 slaves, how can you bring those two statements together in only one way? You deny the full humanity of the slave. The black person is not fully human. And therefore, it's perfectly okay. I'm not denying that all men are created equal. I'm simply demoting blacks to one step below full humanity. And we see something exactly similar happening here. It's in my interest. I'm pregnant again. I've already got 2. Or I don't want this kid. And so I want to get rid of it. And you know what? I kind of believe it's not really fully, entirely, completely human. It will be in 37 days, but it really isn't right now. And this is really a moral blessing. I'm making a moral decision. I deserve moral applause. The point is, you only have to see this from the outside to see, wow. It's not that we don't understand the hardship of it. It is that we are appalled by the rationalization, which is not a female but a human tendency, in which you may say human depravity, the crookedness of human nature, what Christians call original sin, clouds our moral judgment and makes us see convenience in the guise of morality.
I would welcome an answer from both of you for this question, but directly to Mr. Barker. You said earlier in your opening statement that because Jesus didn't specifically state anything against abortion, we should be quiet about it. If that were true, then Jesus never said anything specifically about racism or homophobia. Should we be quiet about those two?
Well, you knew my point. It was talking about those bracelets. What would Jesus do bracelets? So my point was rhetorical. Obviously, people who wear those bracelets aren't doing that. They are injecting more than just what's in the text. So they're being hypocritical when they say, I want to be like Jesus. They're not saying, like Jesus said, that there are some slaves that you ought to beat less hard than other slaves. They're not saying those things. They're better. I think most Christians, most Jews, most Muslims in the world are better than their Bible, better than their book. They're kinder than Jesus ever was, who created a hell and seemed to gloat in this weeping and wailing and gnashing. Any system of thought that has to have a threat of physical violence, which is what hell is a threat of physical violence against someone like me, is a morally bankrupt system. So you have your values, but they're not in the Bible. That's my whole point tonight. They are not godly values. You have your own personal values about these things. So think what you want about Jesus. My point was really to show the hypocrisy of those few Christians who do wear those WWJD pins and bracelets.
Actually, if you think about it for a moment, why would somebody have a slogan that says, "What would Jesus do?" If Jesus spoke explicitly on a given subject, you wouldn't have to ask. Recently, I was in a debate about racism and affirmative action in which we were speculating about what Martin Luther King might have thought if he had lived today. Obviously, Martin Luther King was assassinated in 1968. He doesn't live today. So what would Martin Luther King have thought of hate crimes legislation, don't ask, don't tell, or affirmative action? And the answer is, we have to look at King's principles and extrapolate from them. That's the point of the whole exercise. What would Martin Luther King do? So the point about what would Jesus do is not, if Jesus didn't explicitly address the subject, shut up about it. The whole idea is to think through things like global warming. What were the stewardship principles in Scripture? What did Jesus endorse? And how can we take the principles articulated in a society 2,000 years ago, given to a specific people? Remember, even the letters of Paul were written to specific communities. We have to apply them in a very different context. Poor Dan has lost his whole sense of the historicity of the Bible, the sense that the Bible was written at different times for different groups of people, in a Hebrew language and later Greek that had many fewer words and ideas than we do. So what would Jesus do is an imaginative and moral exercise of taking what Jesus did say and did do and translating that into a new context so that the principles remain the same, but the application may be somewhat different.
We have time for two more questions, and please keep your questions brief. Thank you.
Question for both of you, actually, but I'll direct it to Dinesh first. And by the way, thank you both for being here tonight. Thanks to the two of you, this room is energized. Dinesh, our country's leading abortion rights political activist, Barack Obama, has said that abortion, the right to an abortion, should be there, and it should be legal and rare. So my question to you is, first of all, number one, why would he say it that way if abortion is fine and the fetus is not a person protected by the Constitution, why would it matter? And secondly, can you or Dan enumerate any other right that should be used with rarity?
That's a very... What you have put your finger on is, I think, the rhetorical camouflage of the so-called pro-choice camp. The real pro-choice argument is much closer to Dan's. Abortion is actually, in many situations, a really good thing. And if it's a really good thing, you'd want to see more of it, particularly when those circumstances present themselves. Dan gets royalties because of some Christian songs that he wrote in the past, and he was asked in our last debate, what do you do with the money? And he goes, I donate it to organizations to help poor women to have abortions. So in other words, it's really important for Dan for this not only to be a right, but for a right to be subsidized, for there to be money available for the right to happen. Now, I want to emphasize the radicalism of this, because when you think about it, none of our major constitutional rights are subsidized. I have a First Amendment right to speak. The government doesn't give me money to start a newspaper. I have a First Amendment right to vote, but I got to show up at the voting booth and cast my vote. I have a First Amendment right to assemble, but the government isn't going to provide buses or venues for me to assemble. All our fundamental rights are merely limitations on the government, and there's no necessity for the government to provide the resources or money for me to exercise the right. For the abortion right, however, it is considered to be a meaningless right if it's not available not only to everybody, but the money and the means are not available to actually do it. So this is going beyond the right to essentially conferring positive social blessing on an action and using taxpayer funds, including the funds of people who don't approve of abortion, to allow other people and pay for them to get abortions. So I think that all of this shows the degree to where we have come on this. And I hope that you're right, that this is a sort of clarion call for us to realize that things have reached quite a pass, and it's about time we got active.
Education is a right that we subsidize with tax dollars. The money I give to the Women's Medical Fund is not a tax subsidy. If you're a wealthy woman, that's easy to get an abortion. If you have a lot of money, then that's not a problem. You can go get your abortion. But it's the poor women that are having the trouble. It's the poor women that the Women's Medical Fund helps. And so I'm not going to pay for any rich woman to pay for her own abortion. She can do it on her own. But the Women's Medical Fund helps needy women who want access, who need access to the same. So we're doing it as caring human beings. We're not asking Obama, please, would you pay for that particular woman's abortion? By the way, I kind of agree with you on Obama. I don't agree with everything. I think he's a political animal more than anything. We sued Obama, by the way. You probably heard that we won our lawsuit declaring the National Day of Prayer unconstitutional, and Obama is defending prayer. Obama wants to proclaim America is a praying nation, and so we're in federal court right now. So I think a lot of, when you analyze Obama, there's an awful lot of political things happening there. I like a lot about him, but there's a lot that I don't like, and it doesn't follow that all we atheists are necessarily progressive liberals who agree with everything that the president wants to do.
Our last question.
Hi, my name is Margie, and it's been a wonderful evening. Thank you. My first, can you hear me okay? Okay. The first comment that I would like to make is I've heard a lot about morality.
No comments, questions, please. We have to have a question.
Okay. The question is dealing with, I guess, the morality of it, the pro-choice movement. Where is it that that camp is offering women choice? Because from what I see, it's taking away women's choice, and it's just basically giving them the opportunity to abort or giving them information on how to abort and what to do, but I don't see them offering real choices or taking care of them with the after effects of abortion. Thank you.
One of my other daughters got pregnant in high school, and unlike her sister, who had an abortion, Andrea decided to have the baby and give it up for adoption. I applauded both of those decisions. And I hope you will applaud both of their decisions. They both made an informed choice for their own lives. And it's an open adoption, and there's a child in the world because of that. Nobody, when my Christian wife got pregnant for the first time, she had a miscarriage. And we didn't have a funeral. We didn't feel like there was a human life lost. It was a miscarriage. There was a potential life that was God aborted through her for some reason, probably because of a deformity of some sort, but we don't know. In any event, most of the women that I know who are pro-choice also care about women. They care about abortion, right? They care about helping women. They care about, but the immediate severe problem is for these poor women who don't have that ability. That some of you, I bet you there are women in this audience that have had abortions because you could afford it. What if you couldn't have it that time? You would have felt like you had no choice. You would have felt like your hands were tied. Your life, the misery in your life was, you know, was unbearable. So it's unfair to paint Planned Parenthood as just simply 100% pro-abortion. Planned Parenthood, as far as I know, and I know people who work with them, care about women's entire health lives. Abortion is just a small part of what they do. Birth control is a big part of it. So I think you might be uncharacteristically characterizing them unfavorably. And again, without apologizing for abortion. Abortion is a good thing. Those women who choose it, my daughter who chose it, I applauded her and I support her, and she didn't do anything wrong.
Dinesh, we'll give you the last comment on this final question.
If we look at the rich and the poor in our society, they have different access to all kinds of things, not just material things, but also opportunities in general. So, for example, it's arguable that wealthy white people in America would find it easier to have an adulterous affair than, let's say, a poor person who's living in a different community. The opportunities are less, the resources to do it are less. But I don't hear Dan saying, let's provide funding for poor women to give them equal access to adultery. Why? Because for Dan, there's a real difference between adultery and abortion. Adultery is, by and large, not something that needs to be encouraged, but abortion is. That's why he wants to make sure that the full access, he doesn't say rich people have more access to abortions as poor women. Let me work really hard to reduce the access of the rich, then we'd have true equality. He wants to expand the access of the poor. In other words, he wants to make abortion more universally available because, as he very candidly says, it's not wrong. Well, if abortion isn't wrong, what can be right? It was Dostoevsky who said more than 100 years ago, if God is not, everything is permitted. And Dostoevsky meant this as kind of a warning. He meant that if there isn't transcendence, if there isn't universal morality, we're basically evolved creatures in the world. We're no different than the great apes and the chimpanzees. And when you turn on the Nature Channel, one ape will go into the lair of another, smother an opponent with blows, drag the female screaming into his own cave, rape her, and this is called the Nature Channel. So we don't expect morality in animals, even so-called higher animals. Why? Because we don't consider them to have souls. And therefore, all the moral conduct that we expect of each other, we don't extend to the animal kingdom. Why do we then extend it to ourselves? One of the problems with the sort of atheist materialism is that the best you can do is say, don't harm somebody else. But it can't even say, why not? After all, I don't see any reluctance on the part of the lion to eat the antelope. The lion doesn't apply a no harm principle across the animal kingdom. So the fact of the matter is, even that principle collapses right away, because if ultimately I am simply a product of evolution here to survive and reproduce in the world, it's my own interest alone that matters. Nothing else matters. And if 10,000 people had to be wiped out for me to have one good dinner, why not? What moral principle speaks against that, if not the idea that other people are moral agents? They have, if you will, equal moral value. Well, why do they have equal moral value? Because we were created that way. So it is the act of creation, the act of being subordinate to a higher power, the act of being part of an external morality, that is what confers human dignity, equality. That's what makes utilitarianism and the harm principle even valid. So my point about the atheist is that the atheist is still clinging to a kind of moral foundation that comes out of Christianity, but Dan is not willing to acknowledge it. He doesn't see it. And as Christian assumptions become eroded, we can see the kind of thinking that Dan represents will become more and more pervasive in our society. So as a pro-life movement, we have not only to protect, if you will, life, but also, you may say, the infrastructure of morality and transcendence that gives life its value. Thank you very much.
Thank you both. Thank you both very much. And now our vocalist, Taylor, will come back to the stage and close us out for the evening with a beautiful rendition of God Bless America. Taylor.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from above. from the mountains to the prairies, through the oceans wide with foam. God bless America, my home sweet home. God bless America, my